You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Coming up on the free-for-all, the Tour de France enters its last week. Will we see some excitement for the yellow jersey, or will it be the same old with Christopher Froome? We'll talk Tour de France with the Wall Street Journal's Josh Robinson and Deadspin's Patrick Redford. Coming up, free-for-all.
This is free-for-all from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Hey, this is your good friend Jason back from an extended family vacation. And I use vacation in air quotes because I have small children. They're three. They're one. There's no such thing as a vacation. We were in beautiful places, and yet those kids still get up at 6:15 in the morning. News still happens. Still have to write about Timmy Duncan. Still have to write about Serena Williams. I want your sympathy, people! And of course, my favorite thing to do every July is to turn on either NBC Sports or a highly illegal simulcast from Europe and watch and listen to the sounds of the Tour de France, the world's most important sporting event. And joining me to talk Tour de France, talk bikes. And if you aren't bikey, if you're not a bike lover, man, you know, you're just going to be disappointed because we're going deep on the Tour de France today. Joining me, first off, is Josh Robinson, who is our staff writer on the scene there in Bern, Switzerland, I believe. How are you doing, Joshy?
I'm good. On the scene of a not very restful rest day.
This is the rest day, and thank you for pointing that out. Not really a resty rest day, because the riders still go for a little quick training rides, and they did some press. I know Froome at a press conference today. But is it kind of a, I don't know, chillax scene there in Bern?
You see all the, you run around town, and you see all the team cars parked in front of stores and restaurants, and you're telling yourself, like, okay, they're starting to feel the end. Everyone's counting down the days till Paris at this point.
Now, I don't know Bern at all. Have you been to Bern before, Josh?
No, this is my first time. I've spent a lot of time in Switzerland, thanks to our good friend
FIFA. Yes, FIFA, I was about to say. Now, I know in Geneva, of course, if you're Peter Sagan, you could go to the watch store and raise some serious damage. But what can you do in Bern?
Oh, you can also do some watch-related damage here.
Oh, you can?
You can also sit around and try to keep cool because it is absolutely roasting in Bern.
Oh, is it really? Okay. None of that alpine cool coming down from the mountains?
No. It's that alpine, I don't know what, that's not coming down.
Okay.
Because the guys today, even on their training rides, you could see them suffering.
Okay. Well, Josh, you are on the scene, and also joining us today is another cycling writer who I think is terrific and has become the bane of my existence in some respects because he works at Deadspin. I used to be the guy who in the mainstream press could break the quirky little cycling stories, and now this jerk has come along and gets them before I do because of the nature of his job and what he does, and he does it really well. And so he's caused me nothing but headaches. Patrick Redford joining us from Deadspin. Thanks for being here, Patrick, I think.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Now, you sound a little groggy. Are you in an oxygen tank right now? Are you okay?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm just trying to get ready. My motor went out in my bike, so resorting to conventional means, if you know what I mean.
There are so many questions about this tour, and I don't buy completely into the idea that a tour has become a quote-unquote bore and has become too mechanical. Quite frankly, the conversations that have been happening about Sky have been happening for decades now in the modern Tour de France. But I want to go over a few things that just right from the top. We have some news today, which is Cavendish, Mark Cavendish, who has had a spectacular Tour de France, 4 stage wins, a real surprise for him, a guy who people thought had kind of peaked as the fastest sprinter in the peloton a couple years ago. Real comeback for him, is leaving the Tour de France today to focus on his training for Rio, where he will not be competing in the road race, but on the track as a track rider. And Josh, were you surprised at all by this decision from Cav? Had he done this with no stage wins, no one would have blinked an eye, but the fact that he had 4, huh.
Right, especially as he's inching closer to Eddie Merckx's record of 32 stage wins. I mean, he's now put himself in a position where he could do it, not this year, but probably next year.
Definitely.
If he had another excellent season. Plus, I mean, we know Cav over the past few years loves nothing more than the Champs-Élysées. And to have the Champs-Élysées without him kind of feels weird.
Yes. Regarded as the quote-unquote Sprinter's World Championships, the Champs-Élysées, the last stage, which is quote-unquote a ceremonial stage, but not for the big burly guys who like to get up the front and ride 40 miles an hour for 200 meters. And Cav has won there before spectacularly. And he would have been the favorite, I imagine, going into Sunday. But instead, he is going to focus on Rio. I want to get both of your thoughts about why Cav was so much better this year around. And the other thing that I'm noticing is that you don't seem to see the level of crazed organization that you once did into some of these sprints. And that seems to have helped guys like Cavendish, Peter Sagan, who now has three stage wins, benefiting a little bit from the old days of Columbia with Cavendish. They'd have eight guys riding at the front into the last K, and they'd sort of just gently deposit him in the last 50 meters, and that was that. That's not the way it is anymore. It's a little bit more of a free-for-all. And why do you think that is?
Well, it looks like he's, in a lot of these wins, Cav hasn't even been following his own guys.
This is right, yes.
He's the right one and into the final 200 meters, and then he does his Cav thing, which is fun gap, and blow people away. The other theory that I've heard around is that because he's been focusing so much on the track with an eye on Rio, something about the track training has given him a little bit of extra power coming into the tour this year.
The top end speed is there.
I saw him at Track Worlds in London in March, and he was not amazing there. Part of the discussion was like, well, are they going to kind of wild card him onto the team?
Right. And so, what does this mean for Rio, Josh? What do you think? Do you think Cavendish is suddenly a story, or do you think he should change it up and go into the road race?
I mean, the road race, who's going to ride for him on Team GB? That's the question, because if they're taking Froome, everything is drawn up for him at that point.
Yeah, but Froome's not a one-day racer. I mean, he showed flashes of it a couple of days ago with that Sagan stage, but, I mean, he's not the guy you're going to get to win. I know it's a hilly road race, but this is not a race that's set up for, a pure climber. It's a classics one-day racer kind of race. Am I not right about that?
No, I agree with you.
All right, Redford, what do you think about Cavendish so far?
I've really enjoyed how much he's been wheel surfing successfully, and I think it's a lot more fun than watching, six EQS guys go and just have Kittle win automatically. And
yeah,
as we saw in the one he won, I think it was two stages ago, where Kittle got all mad. Mm-hmm. He didn't need to surf in front of him. Like, the dude is just well and truly on one right now, and it's really fun to see.
I mean, both Kristoff and Kittle have basically come out and said he's the fastest guy right now. I mean, we don't have that top end thing. Well, a nice comeback for Marky Mark. People thought that he might be washed up. People thought that he was dependent on, having the great wheels in front of him like Mark Renshaw and so on. So he's proved a lot. This is kind of his LeBron Cleveland season for Cavendish here. If we have to make a basketball comparison to everything, this really solidifies him, I think, as an all-time. And as far as the Eddie record, I mean, no one seriously is ever going to make a comparison between Eddie Merckx and Mark Cavendish. They're utterly different kinds of riders, but that's a significant mark.
Yeah, I think he'll get it. He's what,
French colleague,
31. I don't think Dimension Data is going to have a GC rider for the next 2 years, and that could be all he'll need to get there. He's in 30 right now, so.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about Chris Froome, who is our yellow jersey holder, entering into Tuesday's stage. Was it 17?
17.
And he talked today and said, look, I'm not going to attack for attack's sake. He's got a comfortable lead over his second place guy, Bogey Molina, and certainly his presumed greatest challenge in the mountains, Nairo Quintana. He's up by more than 3 minutes, I believe. So no real reason for Froome to run away and do crazy things. And yet, everyone likes to speculate about fireworks on the final week. We have not seen the yellow jersey change hands, I believe, in 5 years, not since Cadel Evans and Andy Schleck in 2011. you guys holding out any hope for this, Patrick?
I mean, I saw the story this morning about Movistar and Astana doing an alliance, and that even then, I don't think it's going to happen, especially with this time trial coming up. I think Froome's really going to smash that one because his team's been so good at keeping him out of trouble, and even though he's gone for it on the windy stage and has just generally been more aggressive, I think he's probably still fresher than everyone.
And his team hasn't just been good about protecting him. They've been protecting the guys who are going to protect him in the third week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that story that I think the Secret Pro on Cycling Tips talked about this, how they just stuck Wout Poels back in the middle of the peloton and said, don't do anything, don't pull, stay
for
out of trouble.
For 2 weeks, yeah.
For 14 days, then we're going to, you know, take the plastic off you and you'll chase down every single attack. And we saw it with Bardet the other day.
Yeah.
He just looks at his power meter and goes. It's amazing.
And Poels was also the guy last year who hauled Froome up the Alpe d'Huez when he looked like he was struggling.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, Froome has not shown – I mean, Froome is not somebody who you've not seen signs of vulnerability, especially in the last couple of years. But it does seem like he is a very, very motivated rider with an absolute super team in Sky. And I want to talk a tiny bit about the notion of – you know, Froome being quote-unquote boring, because I think that that reputation has evolved a little bit this tour. I think the crazed downhill attack with the positioning of where his basically his sternum was on top of his handlebar and he was pedaling furiously with a 54 in the front. Then the Sagan breakaway. Where he jumped in with the world champion and really, you know, he contributed big time. And then lastly, you know, dropping the bike and running up the mountain, which for which he would have DQ'd, and is one of the most surreal moments in Tour de France history. Like, you know, it's like crazy that that happens and we don't spend 2 hours just talking about that. But there's been some human to Chris Froome here. And for a guy who's not a terribly elegant rider and doesn't ride with a great amount of panache, he's shown some panache. Josh.
Absolutely. It's kind of like a Team Sky charm offensive in that respect. It's they've heard a lot of people complain about him, and I mean, the Team Sky doesn't do anything that isn't drawn up ahead of time in some way. They're probably the most careful team in the peloton in that respect.
Do you think the downhill attack and the and putting 54 in the front, that was there specifically for that reason?
I don't think they were plan A, but Brailsford, who is the manager of Team Sky, suggested that, like, once things started to break that way, it's a pretty good opportunity to not just win some seconds, but also a few friends.
And I shouldn't be such a dork that I don't, you know, explain what I mean by a 54, which is a 54-tooth chain ring in the front of a bike. The standard is 52, and so if you put a 54 on, that means you're going to be doing some big, big rotating in your pedaling, and it'd be very, very good for a downhill attack or a sprinter or so on. Patrick, does Froome bore you, or are you seeing something a little bit more from him this year?
I've really enjoyed, I wouldn't call it a heel turn, but it's sort of his evolution into Dark Froome, where he punched that fan out and basically said, like, you know, I don't regret it. He deserved it.
Did he knock him out, or did he just give it to him?
I mean, I thought it was a slap or a push, and then you see the other angle where he just winds up and the guy's face gets out of there real quick. So that was, I was a fan of that. And he's kind of talking some smack in the press. He's, you know, giving these quotes like, you know, it must be discouraging for my opponents to see how good my team is and how good I am. I'm into this.
I was surprised that people made hay about the quote unquote fake attack. Like, he's like, he's taunting the. I didn't think that was much of anything. Did you guys?
No.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of thing happens all the time in tactics over race.
I'll say one thing about the discouraging thing. That was in response to my question when I asked him if he thought other people were going to be discouraged.
So you're the stirrer.
If he's talking some smack, it might be my fault a little bit.
That's funny. Okay. Well, it all comes down to you, Josh. You're usually the problem at most of these tours. let's talk about the crazy stage. And, you know, we've all read a billion things about what happened that day and heard a billion things. But I want to talk more broadly about the idea of crowds on mountaintop finishes. I found myself on a competing podcast the other day defending mountaintop finishes. I think there was something very particular that happened on Vontu, which was, you know, they – took away 6K of the course, and all of a sudden you had fans that would have been spread out over a much bigger piece of the mountain, compressed into a smaller area. You were in the forest. The road is particularly narrow there. There were just a bunch of things colliding at once, and this is not to exonerate ASO, the race organizers, but this is not going to happen all the time. And though crowds are ridiculous everywhere, and you see it even in the Tour of California and small-timey races elsewhere, I think it's one of the great things about the sport. I love the look of it. I think that the risk is negligible because the riders are usually going 7 miles an hour up a 14% grade. It's not as if they're, like, you know, risking life and limb. And I'm willing to put up with some of the idiocy that you see up there because I just love it. But I'm willing to be talked out of it. Does anyone want to talk me out of it?
No, I think I agree with you, actually. I think you look at a race like the Giro where they have a lot more sort of official presence, and you still have the crazy fans. You still have the tunnels and the flags and the smoke bombs and everything, but they just make sure that you have a too wide road where someone can attack and get past someone. And I think that is the maximum amount of space you need because, like you said, what makes the Tour different from these other big spectacle sporting events is, like, you know, no one can really afford to attend a World Cup match, whereas the Tour, you just go and drink with a bunch of Dutch people for a week, and it's great.
They've been on a mountain for 48 hours doing nothing but drinking Belgian white beer. I mean, right? I mean, Josh, you were there. We don't have to get into the particulars of the crazy day that you had, but you were in Bedouin, I believe, right?
I wasn't on Ventoux exactly at that point, but... I mean, I've been on these mountains before. I've driven up and down the Alpe d'Huez as well. You know, when they pack people in, especially around Dutch Corner, and it's madness. And frankly, it's amazing that there aren't more incidents if you think about it.
Yeah, it's amazing that there aren't more incidents. And I do feel that there's probably something to be said for, like, you know, 21st century selfie culture and people just kind of amping up what craziness had already existed for years and years. And now, you know, I think these people with their back turned trying to take selfies as the yellow jersey's coming up the mountain. I mean, that's just insane. I don't know what you do to regulate it. I'm positive the riders aren't fans of it. But I like it. And I think for a very vulnerable sport, a sponsor-driven, very vulnerable sport like cycling, I don't want to do anything that discourages fan enthusiasm and certainly the look of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the problem is these dang millennials with their cell phones and the Pokemon, you know?
Yeah, right? Trying to catch a Pokemon on the mountaintop. All right. Now, I want to ask you guys a couple of questions about just other factors in this tour. Nairo Quintana was very much the sexy pick to be the yellow jersey this year. A lot of folks thought, okay, this is the year that he finally does it. He's been the upstart. This would be a remarkable accomplishment. Are you surprised that he's so far off the pace?
Yeah, I've got to say, he just hasn't been in those positions to, you know, to really make it to make an offensive there, because as we've said, sky is so deep. And, I mean, the joke here has become that he's waiting for the fourth week.
Right. Let me ask you this, Patrick. Put Quintana on Sky, put Froome on Movistar. Does this switch around completely?
I kind of think, yeah, personally. I think Froome still picks up more in the time trial than Quintana, so sure, it's definitely close. But, you know, you see Quintana, even though he has Valverde up there, there's four Sky dudes, and he's just looked generally uncomfortable. Like, whether or not he's a better, like, climber on the road and is a more attacking, friendly rider, I think just having that level of team support and, like, utter confidence and someone who will deliver you to the front so you can attack on a descent, I think he'd probably be ahead, but it would be closer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with Patrick on that.
All right. Well, maybe we'll still see something from Nairo here. What is the toughest stage overall that we're heading into here, Josh?
Toughest stage overall. I mean, look, it depends who it's going to be tough for. Is it going to be tough for Froome? I don't see one that's really going to, like, beat him down to the point where he's going to lose a couple minutes.
Yeah.
Tomorrow is going to be a pretty nasty mountaintop finish at Saint-Ou. But that, I think everyone is very wary of that, especially after a rest day. which sometimes can be counterproductive for these guys.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of rest, we're going to take a quick commercial timeout. And when we get back, we'll talk a little bit more about the world's most important sport, pro cycling.
I'm Veronica Dagger, and I want to retire rich. How about you? Then listen to the Watching Your Wealth podcast. We'll help you get there. For more information, check us out at WSJ.com/podcasts and find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Spotify.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. This is Free for All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Back here talking Tour de France, talking about pro cycling with Patrick Redford of Deadspin and Josh Robinson of the Wall Street Journal. Josh, to shift into a more serious topic, we should mention that I don't know if you were the only person to do this, but you had a rather dramatic turn of reporting responsibilities during this race. The day of On 2 was, I believe, the night Nice happened, the attack in Nice, and you were actually summoned to go south and cover that for a few days. Is that true?
I was. I offered the night of, and the decision was made the next morning sometime while I was like on the time trial course at that point, wherever it was, somewhere in Ardèche.
Right.
I have to remember what was going on,
So that must have been a surreal change of environment.
It was, especially because it was a six-hour drive to Nice at that point. And you arrive in Nice and suddenly you're on the Promenade des Anglais, a place I know very well because I was born 15 minutes away.
No kidding.
And it became very strange because a place that is normally so full of beachgoers and
one of the most jubilant places in Europe,
is suddenly plunged into this gloom. And I was there within, probably 16 hours of it happening.
Yeah.
And people were still putting it together in their minds. People who'd been there the night before had come back out just to see and process and realize that this thing had actually happened.
Yeah.
It was tough to listen to the tour on the radio that day.
No, for sure. And this isn't, a glib segue, but cycling is very much connected to Nice. A lot of professional racers live in the region. There is Paris-Nice, of course, which is a very, very well-regarded race. And the tour has been there. And so this was not something that happened, far, far away to other people. And have you had any conversations with people close to the sport since Nice?
Well, today was my first day, full day back on
the
tour. It was a rest day, but people are obviously thinking about it because they all know those roads and the hills behind Nice very well.
Yeah.
Those are hugely popular training roads because they're so brutal. And as you said, a lot of people live there. They've all been there in Paris-Nice, which is a pretty good spring warm-up race for a lot of these guys.
Yeah.
For anyone who was at the tour, my first taste of the tour when I covered my first 1 of 4 was the time trial in Nice in 2013.
Okay, yep. Yep.
Right along the promenade.
Yeah. 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 Well, just a tragic day in the summer that we've already seen way too many of them. Just to make a completely unnatural segue, let's talk a little bit about Peter Sagan. I don't know if you read in the Wall Street Journal, there was this fabulous profile of Peter Sagan heading into the tour, which ended up being just a brilliant choice by whoever wrote it because within 2 days, Sagan won a stage and was in yellow for most of the first week. So good decision by whoever wrote that story. But Sagan...
It was mainly about his hair.
Yeah, that's all I read. So
yes, okay, fine. I focused a little too much on the hair. Maybe I did. And I'm very, very happy to see that he has not cut it. But he won yesterday in a very, very exciting, millimeter photo finish. He has done nothing to diminish his status as the world's most interesting bike racer. If not, the cult gets bigger. What do you make of on the scene, Josh, the fascination with Sagan?
People love him here. People absolutely love him here. And, cycling maybe loves its unwritten rules even more than baseball. And the whole idea that if you have that rainbow jersey, the world champion's jersey, you have to honor the jersey in some way. And he's actually doing it.
Usually it's regarded as a curse. The other unwritten thing is that there's a rainbow curse that you're supposed to be a shitty racer, you know, after you win the thing. And he's been twice as good this year.
Well, which comes on top of the usual Peter Sagan finishing second curse.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Patrick, I am just going to assume here that you're a Sagan guy, but what do you like about him?
I mean, do you remember when he won the Tour of California last year?
Yeah, of course.
That was amazing. He's something I like about him is that cyclists tend to sort of fall into a certain number of boxes. You have your climby GC guy, your sort of punchy climber guy, your pure sprinter guy. And it kind of looked like Sagan was sort of going to be like a Kristoff or a Bösenhagen, but the way he can win on so many stages, I just really appreciate that. Like, there's the one with Froome, there was the sort of mountainy one, and he almost got those three Orica guys on that stage too. Yeah. So just see him win all these different ways is really exciting.
The speculation, quote-unquote confirmation, is that he's moving on next year, that Oleg Tinkoff, despite, you know, stoking rumors of staying in the sport, which, that Sagan's moving on to Bora Argon, which will be Bora Specialized, because Specialized will take over as the bike sponsor. This is a European continental team. They're not a big-time pro tour team yet. They are in the tour. But Sagan would, you know, this would be like taking, you know, a AAA team to big time, like, you know, championship level. What do you make of that move? I mean, because there were a lot of rumors about him in Astana. There were rumors about him with Cannondale last year. What do you make of this move? Does it just seem too strange to sort of put your head around it yet, Josh?
Well, L'Equipe had an interesting thing just this morning about the different budgets of the team, and Bora Argon, as it is now, was in the bottom four on the tour with a fraction of the budget of what Tinkoff has at the moment.
Sure.
And like you say, it would be inconceivable in most any other sport for someone to make that move. As we've discussed in the past, there are a lot of bike politics at play there.
Sure. Sure.
It's pretty interesting to see what kind of team they're going to have to build around him. Although, as we were just saying now, you know, Sagan is a guy who goes off on his own so much and tries so much stuff seemingly off the cuff.
Well, yeah. I mean, you got to figure promises have been made in terms of, okay, we'll bring over this guy and your brother can be on the team and all this kind of stuff with Sagan. I mean, imagine that there'll be a lot of elements of Tinkoff on this outfit. Patchy, his, you know, DS coach, will probably move over to Bora too. And the money has to grow big time, and you got to figure that Specialized is stepping up in a big way there, because for them, he's a hugely important international figure. But it does, you know, it's sort of strange, you know, it just shows the volatile nature of this sport, that, you know, the best rider in it, you know, all of a sudden is going to move to what is, you know, I don't want to say a random team, but, you know, not the obvious first choice. And it just shows what a strange thing cycling can be when you are so volatile and so sponsor driven. I want to ask you, Patrick, if you have any thoughts about Cannondale, our beloved guys from Garmin, who have had some, you know, something of a rough tour. I saw that they're at the bottom at the moment in terms of the standings, or winnings rather. Any thoughts about Jonathan Vaughter's Green Argyle Army?
You know, it was a little disappointing to see Roland drop out, but not the most surprising. I read an interview with Lawson Craddock today where he was talking about just how much more difficult the tour is because it's the thing everyone trains for.
Yeah.
You know, it's like even the Vuelta is people preparing for the tour next year. The Giro can be people preparing for the tour this year.
Right.
But it's good. It's been good to see
him. No one's like, I'm doing the Tour de France to get ready for, you know, the tour of, you know,
for the Doha Worlds.
Yeah, exactly.
It was good to see Ramunas Navardauskas mix it up yesterday.
Yeah.
That's a guy who hasn't done much in a couple of years, but I really like his style.
Yeah. Oleg had some thoughts, as always. Oleg Tinkoff had some thoughts about
the man's got takes.
But, you know, saying, look, you know, I've won more in this sport in 3 years than, you know, Cannondale's done, the Trek has done. You know, this is embarrassing. They need better managers and so on. These Americans should call me. I can give them some tips, et cetera, et cetera. I'm paraphrasing here. But basically, you know, and we do, we all know that that money is really the root of a lot of this, that, you know, Peter Sagan is going to cost you 6-7 million euros. And, you know, a budget team like Cannondale, just, I mean, you can't step to the plate and build a team that way. And, but does that need to happen? Do you have to sort of start to reimagine the sport? If you're, you know, is it enough to be, you know, what Waters has done is astonishing in terms of you know, the track record of producing, you know, stealing wins, producing smart riders, good riders, a team concept, an ethos, you know, the whole thing. You know, they had the nonsense with Danielson last year, which was a real setback. But by and large, you know, it's been a very, very successful effort. And yet it just feels like every year it's hand to mouth. They got to figure out a way. You know, they might not be around if something doesn't bounce the right way. And that's a hard way to operate.
You know, it's interesting. You see, there's sort of these three or four competing models of team ownership. You have the benefactor Tinkoff model, and he's leaving, so that's not necessarily a magic bullet here. Then you have the Brake brand model, which, you know, with Cannondale, they're struggling with money. And then the sort of state-supported Astana Katusha model.
Right, right. The oil
which is,
model.
You know, its own whole shady thing. And there's even rumors that Katusha is sort of having qualms about getting out. So I think there's just no perfect solution. Really, it's kind of depressing, but and more people like Waters are in the sport who are ready to hustle, I think it'll be in a better place.
Do we have that next great American on the horizon? I mean, there are a lot of really, really good American bike racers, but we haven't had the sort of breakthrough superstar yet, sort of that mainstream person. Taylor Finney had terrible luck, of course, with the crash a couple years ago. Hopefully he's going to bounce back and have a good run down in Rio. But, you know, who's the guy on the horizon?
Nielsen Paulus, baby. The guy from Roseville, the teen who did really well at the Tour of California.
Okay. The guy who's on Axel Merckx's team, Axion?
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully. I mean, he's really young, but I liked him a lot in that race.
Yeah. What about Joe Dombrowski.
He's had some nice stage performances across this year, but you know, it's kind of that thing where we keep waiting for the same guys for year after year after year, and then suddenly
they're 30.
Like, all right, the team is going to take a chance with this guy as a leader for a Grand Tour, and then the next year it's actually we're going to a 2-liter model this year.
Right. I always love the 2-liter model. You know, whenever you say we're going in with two guys, that means we have no intentions of winning. I mean, does it ever work? I mean, I guess Astana a couple of years ago with Lance and Alberto, but it just, you know, and I guess Greg and Greg LeMond made a habit of it. Let's talk a little bit about just one other just sort of bigger topic, which is the Tour de France boring? Now, I know that nerds like us can find fascination in the most, you know, small things and stages and get up for like flat, you know, middle of the week stages and so on. But does something need to be done to the overall structure of the event to change some of the predictability of Sky and Froome and sort of these Grand Tour being wrapped up in the middle of the second week? There's been speculation that, okay, you could go down to smaller teams. Maybe it's just five riders a team. I mean, that seems a little crazy, but are there any other ideas out there that you think would be helpful in terms of, again, you know, if mainstream attention is what we're chasing, if, you know, a thrilling last week is what we're chasing, are there things that need to be done? Josh, I'll ask you first.
Penalty shootouts out of team in
Vegas. Yeah, exactly. Josh, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I'll say this. The Tour de France is certainly not boring to be at. Because there's madness every day. Like, even your own personal adventures of like getting from one place to the other, or and like, you know, it's about the speeding tickets you pick up and the dinners you forget to eat.
It's the caravan. But, it's the wine.
The caravan, I have some different thoughts on. especially when you've been stuck behind it going uphill at like 8 miles an hour.
Exactly. It's like, if I see that lion throw one more piece of hard candy, I'm going to vomit.
Hard candy would be like a huge step up. It's like grown men fighting over tote bags. I don't think the Tour de France like needs jazzing up, because that's kind of the beauty of it, right? The tradition. There's a weird obsession with calling certain sporting events boring if they aren't stellar just for 1 year.
Sure.
I covered the Euro right before the Tour, and the discussion at the end was like, actually, it was kind of a mediocre Euro.
Yeah. Right, and it didn't feel that way when you were watching, say, Iceland, you know?
No, to be fair, it felt that way watching Portugal, but...
yeah. All right, you know who to reach out, Portugal soccer fans. That's just Josh Robinson at the Wall Street Journal. But do you know, Patrick, do you think things should be done in terms of spicing this up, especially in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, I mean, the Giro... really onto something. If you let the cyclists punch each other, I think it'll get a lot more mainstream attention.
But okay.
A lot more things.
No, I know, like, the Giro is very sort of gimmick crazy. They do nutty stuff. Like, they'll do, like, okay, we're going to do the Cannibal time trial up a, you know... or a railway road that no one's actually used in 150 years, and like riders are going to go up, you know, 34% climbs in the mud. The Tour doesn't really do that, but do you think they should be doing things like that to mix it up more?
Yeah, I think the Vuelta Giro move of shorter stages, stranger climbs, things like that would be good. Like, I think one of my favorite Grand Tour stages was in the Vuelta maybe 3 or 4 years ago, where it was flat, 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 all along the coast, windless, perfect, and then 2K at 20%. And it's just this insane ramp, and it was so much fun to watch.
Is part of it, Josh, is part of it just ASO? They're like, we have this thing dialed in. We have the TV rights. We know the stages that people get excited for. We just sort of shake them in a bag, and we put them out every year, and that's that. We know we're making a lot of money here. Why mess with that?
And it's not just that. There's an added element of ASO looking back at 100 years of Tour de France and saying, well, we're like a legacy newspaper. You know, we're going to tell you what you need to care about as well.
Right. And we all know that, of course, it did begin as a newspaper stunt, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But as you know, Josh, newspapers have now become the most digitally innovative companies in all of the planet. So, you know, the Tour de France might need to pick up on the newspaper business and evolve.
In the Tour's defense, it has tried in recent years to spice up the first week.
Cobbles
in the past couple of years. We've had, let's throw in as many crosswinds as possible when they made him ride through Holland last year.
Right. And everyone flipped out. I mean, the year that Contador got dropped in that stage and, like, you know, you saw a bunch of GC riders drop out in the first week, everyone flipped on that. They're like, that's not what this was to happen. What the heck? You know, so it does have, you know, you can't please everybody all the time for sure. What about getting rid of the TT?
Well, they did a good job getting rid of the team time trial this year for the Tour.
Yeah.
Because I think the team time trial, as much as I love cycling, might be the most unwatchable part of cycling.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you like it just in the abstract, though, as an idea, Race of Truth?
The idea of the team time trial?
No, just the idea. The team time trial was wacky because, of course, you know, you penalized guys that weren't on great teams and they got sent down the GC standings. But the ITT, do you like having that?
Yeah, I don't mind it. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the longer ones because they're impossible to watch as well, because there's only so much you can watch one guy by himself without any context. But the shorter, punchier ones uphill, those can be fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, guys, thank you very, very much. I'm just going to assume you're going to pick Froome to win this thing, but I'm going to ask you a different final question, which is, what is the nerdiest piece of fashion or tech that you have seen in this year's Tour that have made you say, I would like to have that? Patrick, you want to go first?
You know, I'm cheating sort of, but on the stage that finished in Andorra in the massive hailstorm, Jarlinson Pantano grabbed some spectator's umbrella and finished under it, and I was very into that. Good innovation there.
We should make it mandatory. That would spice it up.
Oh, yeah. Umbrella fights. There we go.
Josh, you see anything nerdy out there that you like?
Oh, wow. I'm mostly into some of the paint jobs. I have to say, I've really enjoyed those. And actually, today, I learned something really cool about the On the Sky bus, which is when you win one of the four jerseys, every morning as your team's bus drives onto through the place you're supposed to go through, someone from ASO stands there and hands you a backpack, and the jersey is in this little yellow or green or polka dot backpack. And that's everything you need in the proper colors for that day. So yeah. I want the backpack.
I'm always fascinated by all that geeky stuff. I love the stories about the guy, you know, the teams making sure they have a polka dot bike and a green bike and a yellow bike, or a guy that is standing by to do that. I want to ask you this, Josh, since you've been up close to these guys. This is Sky's last year in Rafa. I don't know why Rafa's walking away from this thing. It just seems like such a layup for them. World's best team, you know, fancy clothing company. But they're basically wearing lingerie at this point. I mean, it is completely translucent, is it not? I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It's like, wow, it's kind of risque, Chris Froome, what you're wearing.
Yeah, but if you've ever seen Chris Froome up close, he's also translucent.
Yeah, exactly. It is just, I mean, he is an astonishingly great rider, but it is a ugly style. I mean, you know, Sagan is a beautiful rider, Cancellara, a beautiful rider, Contadorium, beautiful rider, sort of fluttering. Froome is not. I mean,
I don't know if it's just me, but he looks extra skinny this year, and his arms are just the craziest arms I've ever seen on an athlete.
Yeah. Yeah. Daniel McMahon, who has been doing some great, great stuff for Business Insider about the tour and is over there, had a funny picture today of Froome's breakfast. I don't know if Froome Instagrammed it or so, but he had 3 poached eggs, some boiled salmon, and half an avocado on the rest. It's like, that's how you stay 101 pounds. Unbelievable. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. As always, Josh Robinson can be found in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, and Patrick Redford, much to my chagrin, is breaking lots of cycling news on deadspin.com. Patrick, Josh, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is the Free For All. This is Jason Gay. Join us next time when we talk about the Vuelta. No, we'll do something else, I promise. Thank you, bike dorks, for hanging in. Bye.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.